Good evening, everyone. My name is Daniel Four. For more information on what I'm doing, check out ancestralmedicine.org. And the talk tonight, I'm calling Conflict for Animists and Other Relational People, which is kind of a silly title. But what I want to get into a bit is the way in which animist values can usefully inform how we're navigating all different kinds of conflict, not only the current political miasma in the United States, but also that, and the way it impacts us personally and interpersonally and all that. So the two key values or frames that I want to make sure are conveyed, and you can do what you will with them, but this is the invitation, the core invitation here is to try on each of these perspectives and notice how this could potentially inform the way you approach conflict, confrontation, sacred fighting. And the first element is animism, and the second is bodhisattva ideal or values or precepts. So when I say animism, I'm taking a British or English word that has been used at times in a colonialist and racist, clumsy way, and at times in a more clear way now, to describe generally how many people see the world, especially but not only indigenous tribal peoples, following traditional ways. And that way of seeing the world generally is that living humans are just one type of person. There are also many other kinds of people that are not human people, but are worthy of consideration and are people nonetheless. For example, the not incarnate right now humans, the ancestors, the spirits of the plants and animals and fungi and mountains and rivers. And when I say spirits of, I don't, it's kind of a funny English construct because it's not separate from their bodies also. So the ones who have different shaped bodies than us that we talk about as plants and animals, and other beings who may be deities, nature spirits, ones we don't have, star people, ones we don't have good vocabulary for in English. But the emphasis is in animist ways of seeing the world is learning how to navigate these other kinds of relationships skillfully. Not all relationships are with equals. Just because you are relating with another person doesn't mean you're on the same playing field as they are. They may be your elder or junior or just radically different in a way that challenges the communication. But there are many, many kinds of people, only a small fraction of whom are living humans. And all of those other people warrant our consideration and respect. And that's a framework that is not very well established in the mainstream of political discourse and cultural discourse. It might be changing a little bit, and it might be a bit more present in indigenous majority or strong minority places like Bolivia, Guatemala, Ecuador, to a degree, some of the ethics in New Zealand with Maori people around the rights of nature. But in general, the animus framework is one that a lot of folks are reclaiming individually or in small communities, but it's still a minority perspective because we still in the West tend to only assign personhood or fully existing status to living humans, and not even all of those. So a lot of the ways that we could think about racism, sexism, homophobia, discrimination based on gender, based on class, etc., is objectification or diminishing of the personhood of those other groups. And so we're saying white people or men or cisgendered people or straight people are somehow more the norm or more legitimate people than others. And so this spectrum between fully validating the personhood of another and all the relational and moral and ethical implications of that compared to objectifying another is a really, really important thing to be nuanced to in how we're interacting with others. Because I would just assume that we tend based on our cultural conditioning, generalizing here, to do a good amount of objectifying of the other than human worlds and other than human people, like the plants, animals, stones, etc. And we also do a fair amount of cultural objectifying of other human people based on our politics, based on our ancestral background and relative privilege culturally. And so a lot of the trouble that we're trying to work through and a lot of the sources of the conflict that we're encountering politically and even interpersonally play out along that fault line where one individual is not extending full personhood to another. There's an objectification. And what I want to give a few examples, animist traditions generally, which include most indigenous traditions, I would say, but are not, it's not limited to indigenous traditions, politically speaking. There are many other people who are animists who are not an indigenous, politically speaking. So indigenous traditions, they're very relational in general. And so, for example, Mongolian teacher friend, Sarangero Odagon, who passed a decade ago, spoke about a troublesome kind of nature spirit called an Aini Burhan, this is from a Buryat Mongol perspective. And in her approach to practice, what I was struck by is if the spirit couldn't be convinced to disentangle from the living human that it was causing trouble to, the options were to attempt to kill it or thrash it into an ineffective state, or adopt it into your spirit family. But at no point is there a sense that you're going to diminish the reality or the existence of that being. In a similar spirit, I've had the good fortune to sit in Inipi ceremonies, Sweat Lodge ceremony with Lakota people and others. And one of the things that people will say a lot is the expression Matakwiasin, and in Lakota language, as I understand it, it means something like all my relations, or we're all interconnected, we're all related. And I've never heard anyone give it the gloss that we're all related except Republicans, or except settler, colonizer, off-putting, aggressive white people. The sense that I've always gotten is that individuals who are acting really poorly are seen as misbehaving, dangerous family members. They're still kin. They're still relatives. It's similar in traditional Yoruba tradition. excuse me, I'm a student and initiate in Ifa tradition, and this is based in Yoruba-speaking West Africa, and so I've been several times there. And in the verses of Ifa, in the scripture, if you will, it's memorized, not written down usually, not just plants and animals and stones and rivers and deities and Orisha are seen as people, but also objects like the shovel made divination for the pickaxe that was going to the hand of the person. And so what we would think of as clearly a non-person, an object, is also seen as a kind of locus of consciousness or activity in a way that warrants consideration and respectful engagement. It's something I love about the traditions, deeply animist. And the point here, this first point about animism, is that it's possible to fully affirm the personhood of another and still strongly disagree with them, still set boundaries with them, still fight with them, still kill them on purpose. And that's the second, let me jump to the second point here, is as an animist perspective on conflict, there's a Maori elder, I sadly don't have his name in this moment, but I could track it down if you wanted it. It's in Graham Harvey's book on animism, which is quite good. And he, this Maori New Zealand elder, describes animism to him as doing violence with impunity, which I think is a really provocative and beautiful way to capture something important about animism. Because if we affirm the personhood of plants and animals, and we're heterotrophs, meaning we eat the bodies of plants and animals and fungi to live, then we are killing our family members. We're killing and eating our family members on the daily. And that's quite intimate. It's provocative. It's aggressive even. And so this elder in his teaching on the subject goes into how if they're going to build a longhouse, if they're going to build a ceremonial house, they need to cut down trees. And so they need to kill in order to do what they want to do ritually. And we all do that. We're participating in killing just to have this conference by using the electricity and energy to power the systems here. And that is not an inherently wrong or bad or unethical thing, but it's an intimate thing that brings us into relationship with the powers that we're killing and calls for a kind of accountability, a kind of showing up for those relationships. And so just seeing the world in a very relational way does not mean you have to always behave peacefully. But you, the ethic, as I discern it and understand it with animist traditions, is that if you're going to kill, understand why you're doing that. Don't be wasteful. And face that being directly and say thank you and receive the gift of that life and know that your life depends on it. So the spirit of seeing others, human and other than human, as full persons and staying in the intent to try to be relationally accountable to them is one piece that is super important to bring to all the, you know, to conflict generally. Like you're fighting with your spouse, you're fighting with somebody on Facebook, you're fighting with a family member. And it's as soon as we slip into you just this, or like, especially if it's all you people or women or men are like this, or you're just generally like this. Like you've become a representative of this group and this whole group is like this. Sometimes those generalizations may hold, but they're almost never helpful. There is a quality of connectivity and relationality that tends to drop out in that moment. And to objectify someone, basically, and you know, we all know what this feels like, but the feeling of you, not only do I strongly disagree with you, You don't exist fully. I negate your existence. It's an aggressive act. It's a provocative demotion in reality to have someone just negate the very space for you to exist. And so it happens all the time, especially for, you know, culturally less privileged groups. And it's possible to bring more awareness to it and to do it less. Let me add to this basic animist framework that I'm laying out the piece around the Bodhisattva ethic or Bodhisattva precepts. So this teaching comes to me by way of Mahayana Buddhism, so Tibetan or Zen, especially those lineages of Buddhism, but it's also found in Ifa, Yorba tradition and other traditions. To varying degrees. And as I understand it, simplified, of course, it's a big topic. It's the Bodhisattva is an individual who aspires to return and keep being born here, keep taking form in whatever way, human or otherwise, until all beings in all dimensions are well. And the ethic is one of radical non-abandonment and of profound commitment to others. And we can arrive at that stance through big heart opening that says, how could I possibly abandon others who are suffering? Which is lovely. And then it becomes an ethic that you're, and a vow, a formalized vow, or just an ethic that informs how you move in the universe. Or you can arrive at that conclusion through a more analytical route that analyzes the nature of reality. And it's like, damn, I can't find any evidence for a full separation between me and others. And insofar as that's the case, the idea that you can be well while others are suffering, others are incarcerated or being tortured right now or things like that, are being blotted out through human-driven extinction, there's a just surrender to the fact that, whoa, I need to commit to participating in the addressing of that, because I'm not ever going to be fully well until all others are fully well, because we're not separable. The hand doesn't wake up without the arm and the other hand, and et cetera. So however you get there, for me, that ethic plus the sensitivity around extending personhood to others feel like the stance that I'm ideally remembering when I'm encountering conflict and trouble. Which is not so much. At the end of the day, I'm a privileged white guy living in the United States, and so I almost never feel physically threatened. And don't tend to encounter nearly as much trouble in a real confrontational way, and in an unavoidable confrontational way, as many other groups, even within Western North Carolina, do. Having said that, I have just in the last year come to embrace a bit more conflict and confrontation, and to see that my own settings around that culturally, and on a family level, I suppose, didn't equip me to embrace confrontation. And a lot of the spiritual teachings that I had encountered previously, some of which have a sort of new age or maybe ungrounded edge to them, also have tended to devalue confrontation and conflict, which I think is actually really problematic, because what it engenders is a way of being that doesn't allow for us to navigate those things, and a tendency to dehumanize or depersonalize or objectify others with whom we come into conflict. And that's see just how many forms of historical trouble follow from that. It's a very common move in the founding of this country and before, being an independent nation in the United States, that is, the ideology really took root of white supremacy in order to justify enslavement of Africans and also Native people. And the need to have racist propaganda and views perpetuated, the atrocities that were slavery, hinged upon the perpetuation of dehumanizing and objectifying perspectives toward people of different ancestries. The same thing's playing out with our way of relating with the other than human world right now. If we see mountains as things rather than people, then mountaintop removal, highly destructive forms of coal mining are totally understandable. If you see the mountain as your child and grandmother and lover all at once, then, not in a weird way, then you are less likely to blow up the mountain and totally fail to have accountability. So we, on the left, are just as guilty of this kind of objectification. And I do it as well. And I try to catch myself with it. And I think there's a way to be connective and to fight well that doesn't objectify. Because if you hold the Bodhisattva ethic of non-abandonment, the terribly racist and corporate dominated bullying, sexist, etc., all the things that are quite, we might think of a shadow material, are that are being acted out through living humans who are quite unconscious or problematically conscious in the United States right now, those are our relatives, and we are responsible to help to reel them in. That doesn't mean we have to be nice necessarily. Animists can have all kinds of strategies. There's a rich tradition in Tibetan Buddhism, which people associate with being friendly, of assassination of people who are being quite problematic. They're given the gift of being killed by others who assess them to be generating so much problematic karma that it's a kind of mercy to allow them to inhabit a new form. And from the inside of that perspective, it's quite understandable. As I understand it, historically in Yoruba tradition, when individuals acted in such problematic ways that they warranted being sent home early to the other world, or executed, as we might call it, the certain ritual group of elders was responsible for making sure that they became an ancestor and that they didn't haunt the community as a troubled ghost. So if you're going to choose to kill someone, which I'm not advocating, it's illegal and almost always a bad idea, even so, it's a kind of intimacy that you need to follow through on. And it's okay to speak of it directly because we ritualize killing through war anyways. Like, we have state-sponsored killing all the time. To pretend that it's something other than that is masking it. And we engage in taking life every day. So how do we do that with an open heart in a conscious way? That's kind of what I'm getting at. Let me say a few more things. I want to be in dialogue mode a bit. I want to share some quotes. There's two quotes that really capture a ton about this topic for me. One is from Philip K. Dick, and the quote is, "To fight the empire is to be infected by its derangement. This is a paradox. Whoever defeats a segment of the empire becomes the empire. It proliferates like a virus, imposing its form on its enemies. Thereby, it becomes its enemies." And for me, I'll share one other similar spirited quote from Audre Lorde. "For the master's tools will never dismantle the master's house. They may allow us to temporarily beat him at his own game, but they'll never enable us to bring about genuine change. Racism and homophobia are real conditions of all our lives in this time and place," at which he was writing it, and still. "I urge each one of us here to reach down into that deep place of knowledge inside herself and touch the terror and loathing of any difference that lives there. See whose face it wears. Then the personal as the political can begin to illuminate all our choices." So for me, there's something about that that is really relevant right now, insofar as there is a collective political barf of historical poison that hopefully is being lanced and cleared in the United States. I don't know if it's going to play out that way, but there's definitely an uptick of ugliness. And how do we transform that without being taken down by it, or without resorting to the bullying and the infighting and the, I think I used in the description, the cannibalizing of our allies? Because there are many people who have generally progressive values and who, if they don't say something just right, interpersonally or especially on social media, just get shredded by another dynamic or another demographic of people. And it's discouraging. It's really counterproductive. And it shows me that there's a lot of folks who still don't know how to fight well and fight connectively in a way that actually is beneficial for those engaged. Yeah, I don't want to talk it to death. Let's be in dialogue a bit. If you have something, find where the energy's at here for you, and I can take you off mute as well, or you can type in something, either way. But it's such a big topic, I'm not sure exactly where to follow the energy. So yeah, speak up if you would, folks. Yeah, it helps me. Yeah, good. Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
I can, yeah.
Yes, okay. My name is Patty and I live in California.
Yeah, great.
I'm just going to say one thing that I just said this morning to a friend. I think that categorizing is basically a defense mechanism from the complexity of what's in ourselves. I experience that within myself, that when I'm willing to embrace my own complexities that are revealed to me vastly in my world around me and in my dreams and in my feelings and in my thoughts, it doesn't allow me to categorize that or anybody I might project any of that out onto.
It's good. There's one of the things about being skillful that just takes practice is knowing how to really hold your own position ancestrally, culturally, know where you're speaking from. So in that way, things are not colorblind, they're not gender blind, they're not, you know, we do have our own respective filter and our own background. And yet there simultaneously is a deep underlying connectivity and oneness to things. That's also real and true. And it becomes a question of how is it being wielded in the moment. I saw maybe an hour and a half ago some dialogue on Facebook. It was going well until someone chimed in like, it's all one. Why do we need to worry about the words? Why do we need to give sensitive, you know, why do we need to be sensitive to this when it's all one? And everyone's like, ah, and then just piled on her in a, like, you just asked for it. The liberals are going to take you down now. And which is warranted, but even the response, like a third of it seemed like genuinely trying to reach her and be like, no, well, a colorblind stance is actually problematic and words actually are important. And other people were just like, fuck you and your stupid fucking oneness horse that you rode in on and just die. And I'm like, oh, yeah. Okay, that's cool. Way to really help out there. So so following you, Patty, about that dance of deep kind of mystery that we're made of and being in our individual unique beauty within that. So,
and I'm particularly challenged, and yet I can see the value in it because I know it's active in my life. That concept of killing as an act of intimacy. I'm not there because of something in me has this sense of value for every human being. And everything, and that killing it is like saying, no, there's no more time left for you to change. And I have no more hope for you. And I just am very, I know this is probably naive in some way.
It's a great thing to grapple with. For one, we're all going to have our chance of being offering for the spirits, for the earth. And so we're all going to die, of course. And so it's not like we don't get a turn at it. In Yoruba tradition, we do what some people would call animal sacrifice. Other people would call the ritual preparation of dinner. And we eat the bodies of animals, much like other people on Earth. And it's quite intimate, even just to pull the head off of a chicken and to pray with it and be like, hey, thanks, friend. Like, good to appreciate your life. And thanks for participating in these prayers. And yet, most people probably on this call eat poultry at some point in time. So we're hiring other people to do it. And so then when someone does it, if I put on Facebook, yo, animal sacrifice, people would like Yeah. I mean, I do put that sometimes, but what I'm really saying is the ritual bringing awareness to the process of killing that we're already engaged with.
Yes.
And it's quite intimate. And so to kill another being is not to devalue it. In our tradition, some people are like, oh, sorry, pig, sorry to kill you. And I'm like, no, that's not how the elders hold it. You say, you know, thank you for your life. We appreciate you. Your life sustains our life. And so there's a receiving of the gift of the lives of others. And if that causes us to feel an imperative to use our life well, good. It should.
What hits me is that the act of killing somehow must never be attached to the adrenaline of anger.
No, I agree. Oh, yes. Yes, I agree. Yes. Or, I guess exceptions would be in the larger meta structure of a decidedly just war, which if, you know, I believe defensively there are such things in this time. If it benefits those warriors who are carrying that out to be in a kind of berserker mode, I don't know if that's anger, perhaps. But adrenaline may have a function in that situation. But unplanned, spontaneous killing from anger is almost always not the way to go. It's definitely ritually not what you want to do. So, yeah, thank you, Patty. It's an important distinction for sure. That's the other side of it. Yeah. Question, I want to go ahead and put you back on mute. Good to see your face. Yeah. Tay is saying, try and figure out how to be with the suffering of others. You work in a middle school with students in poverty and vulnerable, undocumented folks without losing your center. And how, especially with the constant conflict and sense of threat. Yeah. So, and with family members as well. So how do you stay well within that? I mean, I don't think there's any one answer, but if you're going to be in the storm, there's a real need or imperative to have a strong spirit practice to reaffirm and strengthen your commitment to have a long, healthy life, and to not to understand that it does not benefit the cause to drown in it any more than being pulled down by drowning people is really a transformative action. And so being fiercely protective of your particular center and happiness so that you can do what you're doing as long as you choose to be doing it. And the other bigger question is to be certain that the work you're doing is in alignment with your destiny. I'm not suggesting that it isn't, but if we're doing work that's in alignment with our destiny, we'll tend generally to have more stamina for it. There will be a sense of soul alignment for that work. But to find ways to ritually fortify and layer up, and then to transition out of the space. For people who have heavy jobs, it's nice. It sounds like a simple thing, but it's good to change your clothes after work. It's good to actually ritually transition out of the energy somehow. And if you're going to take on a lot of responsibility, you need to have a doubly intense ritual practice of recharging and make sure that you're allowing the spirits to hold the heaviness. Because if you try to hold it personally, it'll just accumulate in your energy body in a way that leads eventually to burnout or sickness or just walking away from it. Yeah. Jackie's also saying to use water as a cleansing. So yeah, bathing, washing, things like that for sure. I'm going to take you off mute for a sec. Does that land all right, Taya?
Yeah, that's really helpful. The reframing of thinking about the intensity of the work and that ritual self-care should be equally intense. In a positive sense, that's really helpful.
And also, tough work is going to light up every insecurity and vulnerability and everything in your being as well. And so to the degree that we're not really emotionally worked through, whatever it is, something that seems like a small thing, you get in a tough environment and then that's operating. And then you go from 100% energy to 80% because your own unresolved emotional stuff is causing drag on the system. It also creates a vulnerability where other energies can kind of glom onto it and you get in codependent projection land. And so there's a need to be fierce and crystalline and boundaried and like on your vital A game as much as possible. And then when you're not there, to transition all the way out and to advocate for getting paid even more if you can. When you're working hard, it actually matters to get paid a lot.
It does matter. If that's also a side suffering, the lack of pay, that just exacerbates it. Yeah.
Oh, it does. It totally does. It matters. Yeah. Good. Yeah. Thanks. Thanks, Tay. Yeah. Others, okay. Jackie, I'm going to unmute you. Go ahead.
Yeah. So I think that there's something for us to talk about when we're pontificating and we're not living in it.
Yeah.
And to really be able to identify for ourselves, where is it in our life? Like I know that you have an interest in Judaism, and the Torah portion 2 weeks ago was Mishpatim, and it's all about the other and prohibitions against the stranger. And 36 times in the Torah, it's mentioned this prohibition, which, you know, is a significant number. And there's no other prohibition mentioned that many times in the entire Torah as a prohibition against treating someone like the other, ger, Hebrew word ger. And so I run an elder abuse program, response and prevention, and I work in a domestic violence agency, and it's Jewish agency, and I'm Jewish, and I'm part of the security system for where all the bomb threats have come through in the last several weeks. And so coming through my telephone are things like the JCC is being evacuated right now. Please make sure that you get your children's coats on, line them up, have them be silent, and walk them down to the Chai building in silence. And I can look out my front window of my office and watch in a line all the little duckling children who are being marched to the Chai building. And everywhere in my body has a reverberation of people marching into the gas chambers. And one of the ways that in my office we deal with the horrific aspects of humanity that will horrifically abuse an elder, it's so difficult to wrap our heads around it that I think how we deal with it is, we call those people fucktards. And we have to find a way that we can cope with what is not even like fully present in our bodies and in our psyches, because it's so difficult.
Yeah.
So I've been listening to you. I'm having this kind of thought that anger is like, it gives the same adrenaline release as any other addiction. So when there's like that really intensive buildup of anxiety and stress, and then a person just rips it out, they're lost. They're not even present anymore. So the idea of being so not present that there can't be any awareness of God, I think might be something about why there's this prohibition, because we lose our ability to be in connection with God.
Yeah, I'm following. It's, you get this, most people, but not all people get it, and a lot of people who come to spiritual circles don't get it, that there are forces not only in the seen world, but in the spirit world or in the unseen or the subtle worlds that are quite hateful and dangerous and real problematic forces. And in other words, there's not two worlds, really. There's the more dense world that we clock as physical because of our hardware and what we're able to perceive on a certain bandwidth. And then there is the much more inclusive spectrum of things, or the much more inclusive ecology of things. And so whatever horror we know of in this dimension has a spiritual or unseen face to it as well. And how do we not other the beings who do that to us, the ones who would threaten us, the ones who would negate our existence? That's the most challenging kind of topic in a lot of ways, because I was in a couple-day workshop with Martin Prechtel, and he's quite beautiful and articulate in his speech, and so I wouldn't capture it in the way that he would, but we were building a house or a sacred vessel for the holies or Holy Mother. I don't know the exact wording, but very beautiful. And there was a process of casting out of that space the energies that would destroy children, or I don't know how he said it, but this spectrum of energies we're talking about, the ones that would call the JCC and be like, bomb coming. And he was very clear. He's not saying I negate you. He's not even saying we judge you. They're just saying you need to be somewhere other than right here, right now.
You are not welcome here.
You're not welcome here. You are clearly part of the larger ecology of what is. May you be well. But it is my choice to assert a boundary. And anger is good medicine for boundary setting as well. And being able to say, no, this is not acceptable. These policies are not acceptable. These ways of speaking or relating with me or with this other person are not acceptable. It's possible to fiercely and fairly assert a boundary without objectifying or denigrating the reality of the being you're interacting with. And not all beings that present as human are fully human in the way we think of it. There are other than human energies which are, they're just ecologically different. They eat fear and hatred and confusion. So they're on a diet of things that we've tend to wish that they weren't, because we don't want a planet full of suffering. And so I don't even jump to say that they're the things we would think of when we say evil. And it's enough to say there's no food for you here. May you be well, or you cannot have my children today. Many cultures personify death and will ritually feed death in order to, as a substitute for one's own life. And in that, it's possible to have a kind of kindness even toward death, and to know that death also needs to eat, and to have a preference that it's not you today. That's okay too. So, yeah, I following you, Jackie. I know I just did a little talk about there, but thank you. Thank you. I'm gonna go ahead and thank you for your service there. I'm gonna go ahead and mute you and invite others who may wish to speak up in some way. I don't have an easy way for the phone folks to. I don't know if you're able to unmute yourselves there easily. So what I can do actually is unmute everybody for a second. So if you're, and if you're on a phone person, Does anybody have a question that wants to speak up that hasn't yet? All right. put you back on mute then. Okay. So we got a few minutes. We can finish, but I'm just kind of dropping in because there's so much that could be said here. I've noticed my own process around being at times attacked sounds a little dramatic, but it's a kind of low-grade form of attack when someone comes at you really hard and aggressively on social media. It's to call it an attack is kind of rude toward people who are actually physically attacked, but to notice that kind of energy, which has probably come at most people here. And I have tended to see if people are able and willing to engage, but I've become less willing over time to entertain people who don't seem interested in actual dialogue, and have been exercising the block function occasionally, even when people are choosing to be physically threatening to me for reasons that I just think are I don't agree with. And well, and so we could talk for a while about how social media functions, but I think there's a benefit. I will say I think there's a benefit to trying to utilize when you have the resilience for it, for reaching those who can be reached, and to understand that not everyone is in that category. And you may find that based on your ancestral experience and life experience that you're just not going to do that kind of work because you're kind of fucking over it. And if that's your condition, totally fine. Like, it's not everybody's calling to try to do the bridging. Some people have lived with so much grinding, like discrimination and unreasonable treatment for years, that it is totally unreasonable to expect them to engage in that kind of bridging. So respect for that. Anybody else have anything that you want to speak to?
Yeah, I do. This is Natanya.
Yeah, great. Please.
I would love you to speak to different styles in conflict. Like, I feel like there's often unspoken agreements about how we will interact with each other in conflict, and that if people breach those agreements, they're kind of thrown out of the room. Like, oh, I'm not going to hear your argument because you're not arguing in the way that I like to hear.
Right.
That is super damaging to having a whole culture, and I would love you to speak to that more.
Yeah. Well, it depends. How to say, it's ideal to be flexible enough and secure enough in yourself that you're willing to roll with different people's styles. Mm-hmm. And as someone who leads groups, someone may come at me in a way that feels quite confrontational and is different than my style. And others in the room might be like, oh my God, like, is that really okay? But it's okay from that person. Like, if a different person were coming at me that way, I'd be like, really? Really? So it depends who it is. And real generally speaking, people of historically oppressed ancestries, I think it's good to have a great deal of leeway and not be tone policing and not... if you're in a space where you're responding to someone's pain or someone's concern that's being raised, generally to have a lot of leeway for that within bounds of tending to the overall group. On a sacred level, we've talked about it in other calls, everybody has their own affinities with the spirits and with...
Right.
And so we're not all children of the same deities. And so... because we don't have that framework really deeply internalized, we'll tend to value our style over others. Like, I'm actually kind of diplomatic and a Libra and have a lot of Venus-like energy in my space and really like the relational approach. So when people come without a lot of tact and they're just blunt and unfiltered, I have to breathe and remember to not take that personally and to receive it well. And there's such an opportunity of people. Fighting is an intimate act that is almost always a longing for communion and connection. Mm-hmm. I was assaulted 13, 14 years ago, and I'd never been really robustly punched in the face before. And I didn't understand until kind of my process after that and the dreams after that, how intimate violence is. Like, I may have understood it intellectually, but I understood it more directly and intimate, not in a beneficial way, but in a way that really penetrates into your being. And if we can slow our own reaction down, there's a possibility when people have a bit of openness and they're coming at us to recognize that often they're actually longing for a kind of connection. Mm-hmm. And so there's like a fuck off, I love you combination coming sometimes. Like, there's this fighting is complicated in that way. And if we can really slow our, like, the ideal superpower with fighting would be to really have slow motion time. So you can stay present with your own reactivity and decide who is in front of you, whether or not it's safe, whether or not you wish to engage. And if so, where is this person really coming from? Mm. Is there an opportunity to actually transform and break through the objectifying that's probably occurring to a certain kind of connection and understanding, or not? Because sometimes it's not an option. They're just coming with fight and not openness. So anyways, those are a few thoughts, but for sure we have different styles and it's good to respect that if we can. So. Thanks, yeah. Natanya.
Yeah,
thank you. Yeah. Anybody else got anything you want to speak to before we finish up soon? Is that, you look like Kira, maybe? You got something, Kira?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm just wondering, like, in situations like you were talking about with social media or in, like, polite company or just pretty much all the time when you can't just, like, hit each other like children, like, what are some good strategies to channel that kind of, like, bodily energy into, like, staying present and connected and not just, like, getting lost in, like, that?
This is a therapist move, but one move that almost always works well and buys you time and tends to diffuse intensity is to practice really accurate listening to the person.
Okay, like, and
it sounds like you're saying this. It sounds, Kira, like you're asking for strategies for knowing how to navigate situations where they're really charged. Did I hear your question right? And that kind of... Go ahead. Did you actually want to say something? Yeah.
Yeah, no. Well, I just had another part to it, which is like, Good. Do you feel like that strategy that you're talking about also works to diffuse it from the other side? Like, if you're not the one who's angry, like...
That's especially when I mean it.
It works like both ways. Like, you can do that for yourself and slow down, but you can also do that for the other person. I don't know.
Specifically meaning when people are coming at you in a charged way. If you can... one of the skillful qualities of a good debater or someone who's critiquing is they can reflect back what is being said to them in a way that causes the person saying it to feel not just accurately heard, but understood in a even new and fresh way. Like, wow, I feel really seen by you. Yes, that is what I mean. I am really concerned about the overspending of our budget, and I feel like our country would be better if we didn't just give all these entitlements and all this money away to poor people, because I do have a value that if you work hard, then you should have everything you need, or, you know, whatever it is. So, and you might not agree with it. You don't have to agree with it to really skillfully, accurately reflect it back. But just that action about, like, I hear you. And if you can find something to join with on that, be like, I also have a, there's a question I'll get to in just a sec. Like, I also have a ethic of people. Yeah, people should be hardworking. I agree. And find something to agree with on it. It tends to disorient the person coming at you. So it's the, in Aikido, it's like the joining before the flip and body slam. And so the follow-up is like, okay, I hear this, but based on this ethic, how would you speak to this situation where someone doesn't, you know, have the same privileges or whatever? So then you can actually dialogue. Like, it sounds basic, but really skillful mirroring and listening will often diffuse conflict, not always, and it will buy you time to gather your own response if things are moving quickly. Again, it's a challenge of slowing down and being able to say, hey, I need a minute, actually. Let me just think on that for a minute and know that you can actually own the rhythm of the interaction.
Cool, thanks.
Yeah, sure. But not actually, so somaticizing maybe in order, acting out the motions and sounds, not actually onto the other person. Holding it. I'm not entirely following the nuance of it, Jackie, but I think you're saying to reflect back, but not totally embody and take on the energy yourself, something.
Are you asking me?
Well, yeah, I see you posted, so I want to respect what you're sharing here. Yeah.
Well, I was thinking about her question, and what I was perceiving was that because she had all this body language, you know, there was all this movement in her body. And so what I was perceiving was like, she's got all this energy stored in her body while, you know, this interaction is happening. And what does she do with all this energy in her body? And so, you know, in somatic work, you know, a lot of times there can be that acting out, like grunting and like, you know, I want to kill that guy, you know, but like getting it out of the body, but not projecting it actually onto the other person.
Sure. Yeah, sure. We carry the stories of our ancestors, and those can come through at any moment in a way that floods our individuality and in a way that causes us to show up and respond very differently than we would just a minute ago to what was happening, because suddenly they're sitting more vividly with us. That's opportunity, but it's, if we're not in relationship with them more consciously already, it can tank the interaction quickly. And so respect to all that's in the room when we're interacting just with another person. So we'll finish up here in just a moment. Thank you, Kira and Jackie, both for that. And just to reiterate, the invitation is to hold the people who really just make you crazy as wayward relatives, as family, that you cannot even over many lifetimes disown fully. That they're kin. They're more directly, they're part of your body. They're an aspect of yourself. So when someone is acting out whatever bullshit thing they're acting out, you could legitimately ask, why am I doing that? Why would the extended interconnected me do such a thing? And in that way, not make unnecessary separations. And to hold an ethic of non-abandonment, which can allow for boundary setting, rage, intentional killing if needed, not recommended, but if needed. And so accountability to others can take many forms, and it's possible to bring even into our killing and eating the connectivity while taking life. So all that, I'm going to stop recording here. If folks want more information, check out ancestralmedicine.org.